WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me now is bop trumpeter Red Rodney, whose early work we heard an example of in the opening tune. He grew up in Philadelphia, but by the age of 15, he was out on the road playing with bands like Jimmy Dorsey, Les Brown, and Gene Krupa. He spent much of 1948 and 9 with the Woody Herman Band, but later in 1949, he began his 8-month stint with Charlie Parker. We'll be hearing one of their few recordings together in a few minutes. In the 1950s, Rodney worked with small bands around Philadelphia. He served some time in prison, which disrupted his career a couple of times. He's now recording for Muse Records. Just a couple of days ago, he returned from a tour of Israel. He's in Philadelphia today for a rare Philadelphia performance, tonight at the Stenton Diner, and that's on Washington Lane and Stenton Avenues. The concert will begin at 8:30. With Red Rodney on trumpet will be Turk Morrow, who'll be featured on tenor and baritone. Jerome Hunter will be featured on bass. Mickey Roker, the Philadelphia-based drummer who tours frequently with Dizzy Gillespie, will be featured on drums. And Sam Dockery of New Jersey, who's joined us a few times on Fresh Air, will be featured on piano. And this concert is being produced by Joe Siegel, who you may remember from the Penn Jersey Jazz Friends, and he's also made recent appearances on Fresh Air. And the MC will be WUHY's Bob Perkins. Joe Siegel, by the way, has loaned us some records from his own collection, which feature some of Red Rodney's earlier sessions, and I understand, Red, that you haven't heard some of these in a long time, like that Krupa record that we just heard. Well,
no, I haven't. In fact, I don't think I ever heard it before.
Never. Well, I'm always surprised, by the way. Musicians don't have their own recordings, and it's the collectors who have to play them.
That's
for the musicians.
That's very true. Very true.
Red Rodney, how did you first pick up the trumpet?
Well, I was living in Philadelphia, and I was playing with a bugle and drum corps, the Jewish War Veterans, post number 13. And I was a bugle player. And as a bar mitzvah present, I got a trumpet.
Did you have to play for bar mitzvahs when you started to
be a proficient? Well, I did some of that also, right here in Philly.
A lot of schlocky kinds of tunes, or did you get to play music that you wanted to play?
Well, we played good tunes, but of course that's a different idiom of this business, and you have to play party music, which can be good for those who want to do that. I think when we graduate into jazz, we have to stay away from all that.
What was the jazz scene like when you were growing up in Philadelphia?
It was very good. The war was on, and places were thriving. There was the Downbeat Club here, which was the, as much as New York's Three Deuces at 52nd Street, that was the beginning of modern jazz, so-called bebop at that time. Dizzy Gillespie had worked there before he went to New York. I came in after Dizzy had already left. At that time, it was 1945, I was with Elliot Lawrence Orchestra at WCAU Radio. There was no television then. And at night, we played at the Downbeat. And this was like going to school. We were learning how to play. Jimmy Golden was there. Philly Joe Jones was there. So many other great Philadelphia players who since had gone to New York or elsewhere and made their mark in this business. So we had good training here in Philly and very good background. And of course, many of the great musicians who came from Philly, and there are many, all were very schooled because the music schools in Philly were exceptional. And the teachers here were exceptional. And most of us learned how to play at a very young age.
Well, you went on the road when you were 15. Was that considered unusually young, or do you think that was typical?
Well, I was a little older than 15.
Ah.
It was young because there was a war on and all the good players were drafted. And so I got with a house band at the Steel Pier who, named Alex Bartha, and I understand he died yesterday at 85 years old. Joe Siegel was sitting there and shaking his head, and he told me about it. I was in his orchestra. And all of the name bands used to come and play. And I learned all of the tunes and all of the solos that they were playing, and finally, one day, when they needed somebody, they'd call me to sit in with them. The first time I left home was with Jerry Wald. It's a big band in those days. And then Jimmy Dorsey. I stayed a while and always came back to Philly. And in 1945, I stayed here for that year to work with Elliot Lawrence and work at the Downbeat. This is when I first started playing jazz. listening to it, understanding it, with the help of people like Jimmy Golden and Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, whom I met through Dizzy.
When you were playing in the big bands, were you considered like the kid of the band?
Yeah, I was usually the youngest member in those years. Yeah.
Was there an initiation process that you were put through before you were accepted?
Not really, no. No, everybody was very nice and everybody was very helpful. Musicians are that way. There's a lot of love in this business. And even when someone has a little personality defect, it's overlooked and with hopes that they'll correct it as they mature and get older.
How was it hard to learn all the tunes in a book when you were joining up a band?
No. No, not really. You sit in with the band and you sit and read the music and you learn the conception of the band and in a very short time you have it.
There's a lot of stories about Lester Young when he joined Fletcher Henderson's band for a short time that Henderson's wife used to play him all these Coleman Hawkins records to show him how he should sound because they were used to Hawkins' tenor playing and couldn't get adjusted to Lester Young's. Did you ever find a similar situation where a band leader expected you to sound like a different trumpeter from the one you really were?
I had that with Tommy Dorsey. He wanted me to play a certain solo and a certain tune, and I played it my way, and he wouldn't hear it. He wanted it the way it was recorded. Well, I was very young and very cocky, and so I said, no, I won't do it, and left. Maybe it was the right thing to do, but looking back now, I think I should have compromised a little bit.
Who did he want you to sound like?
Ziggy Elman and Chuck Peterson and a tune at that time was very popular called We'll Get It. And just before I left, I showed him that I could do it, and I played it note for note.
Sounds like a movie, doesn't it?
Yeah.
What were the favorite bands that you played with?
The ones that I were with. Gene Krupa's band that you just heard was the first of the big white bebop bands.
You don't think of Krupa, I don't think of Krupa's band as being a bebop band.
No, but toward the end of that band, it became that way. He had writers like Jerry Mulligan, who at that time was writing in that direction, leaning in that direction. The two Philadelphia guys, or the three, Charlie Ventura, Jerry Mulligan, and myself, contributed a lot of the more bebop orientation of that band. And then a few years later, I went with Woody Herman, which was a great band. I think that was probably the greatest band I played with, musically. The Four Brothers band with Stan Getz, Zoot Sims, Al Cohn, Serge Shaloff, Bill Harris, myself, Shorty Rogers, Ernie Royal, Lou Levy, Terry Gibbs, Oscar Pettiford, and Chubby Jackson, one or the other. So that was a great band.
Let's talk a little bit about the time that you spent with Charlie Parker, which was starting in 1949. How did you first meet him?
Well, first of all, I was with him for 3 years, not 8 months.
Oh.
Yeah, that someone wrote that in somewhere, and it's...
Encyclopedia I've been
asked
Jazz,
about,
to
Yeah,
be
I've
precise.
Been asked about that a lot. Yeah, Leonard Feather makes more mistakes than anybody I know. I joined him in 49, and I stayed until the end of 1952, when I came back to Philadelphia and got my own band at that time. But I first met Charlie Parker through Dizzy Gillespie while I was living here in Philly. Once I heard him, I knew the direction that I wanted to go in music. And I used to take the train up every weekend and go to the Three Deuces in New York and listen all night long, then get back here for the Monday afternoon radio show. I got to know him, but we got friendly throughout the next 3 or 4 years. While I was with Woody Herman, Miles quit to get his own band. And I got a call from Charlie Parker asking me to take his place. I was very excited and flattered and honored, but I also was very frightened. I didn't think I deserved that. I knew there were other players that were better, that were more deserving of that. And I mentioned that to him, and he said, well, maybe so, but I called you, so don't be a fool. Come on. Mm-hmm. Which I did. And I gave up a very high-paying job with Woody to go to one of the lowest-paying jobs I ever had with Charlie Parker. But that was like going to graduate school.
How did he teach you a tune?
He didn't. You asked about rehearsals. I don't remember ever having a rehearsal in the whole 3 years I was with Charlie Parker. We played the tunes that everybody knew. When a new tune came up, he just called it out and played it, and we got it that way. There was never time for rehearsals. even on some record dates. We did it right in the studio. And he used to like the first or second take. We'd never make too many.
That's difficult for me to understand in the sense that some of the chord changes seem so hard and some of the rhythms so complex and difficult to play. It's hard for me to understand how you'd be able to do that without really sitting down and rehearsing.
Well, once the tune was identified, we had a pretty good idea of what it was. If it was something mainly that I didn't know, because chord changes never bothered him. He either heard them, had a pretty good knowledge of them, and had great instinct. So they didn't bother him. If he heard a tune and liked it, he'd play it. Once I heard it a little while, I got it in my head and my fingers, and it was okay. The arrangements came naturally. It was only a quintet. We played the head, and then each one blew on it. No, I don't ever remember having rehearsals. I do remember times that Norman Granz was screaming and hollering because Bird didn't show up on time for a rehearsal. But he never made it.
Did he ever give you any feedback on your playing, make any suggestions?
Not overtly. He was always very supportive and very complimentary. When I needed criticism, he didn't do it verbally. He did it more musically and more subtly and in a very beautiful way. He was a very kind, considerate person. And I think he was aware, with me and with many others also, if he said something to really make us feel bad, it might do more harm than good. And he knew just how to get the best out of you. I've seen him do that with a number of people. He was always very helpful, very considerate.
You said that the band didn't rehearse, but as we'll hear in a minute when we hear a session that was recorded with you and Parker, you had an incredible velocity. Now, you must have practiced a lot yourself. How did you develop the speed that you did?
Well, your technical proficiency comes long before you become a jazz player. It enhances itself, it improves itself with the playing of jazz. But all of this came while I was living in Philadelphia, studying music, playing around, playing every kind of a job that there was to play. So when you finally get into the big leagues of jazz, so to speak, and when you're with Charlie Parker, I think you're in the major leagues. You have all of the equipment. Now, how to make music out of it is another thing. One thing he did teach me is not to use all of that technical proficiency. And he once said, silence is music also. Which, at the time, I didn't understand as well, but I certainly do now. Maturity will make somebody understand that.
Did you find Parker to be very charismatic at the time?
Only because he was such a great artist, and everybody was enthralled by him and paid homage to him. And he didn't really know how to accept all the applause that he got and all of the devotion that he got. It embarrassed him. But charismatic he was because of that. His personal hang-ups also made him charismatic because people told a lot of stories about it. Many of them were untrue. Some were true. He was quite of a character.
One of the traits that he had, which a lot of other musicians ended up following, was shooting up. And did the heroin affect his music at the time that you were playing with him? Could you hear that?
Strangely enough, no. It didn't affect his because, as I said, he was an outright genius. Just imagine how much better he would have been if he wasn't addicted. I know from personal experience, you have to be healthy to play. When you're using drugs, you're not healthy. I know it affected me terribly. I didn't get better. I got worse. My own self, and in many other people's. But, of course, he was so great. I could see the man actually sick many times. You'd never hear it in his music.
Was there a feeling at that time that if you shot up, that somehow that would free your thoughts and help you play more beautifully or more...
It probably was. When I first went with him, I was young and clean, with no bad habits. I stood next to this colossal giant, night after night, seeing him addicted and bombed out, and playing so great. I was very young and rather immature, and I probably felt that if I crossed over, perhaps the same thing would happen to me. Of course, it wouldn't, it didn't, and it couldn't. But I understand why so many young people followed in his footsteps. And we even followed the bad examples that he set. If you notice, many of the older ones, like Dizzy, and a few who were already mature, they didn't do that. It was just a very young, impressionable young players who got messed up in the same thing he did.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, how the stereotype of the jazz musician is someone who drinks too much or does too much of one thing or another, but it really does take physical stamina to play.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. Any instrument.
Particularly a wind instrument, don't you think? Well, of course, drums require quite a bit of energy, too.
I'm going to quote an old great saxophone player, Vito Musso, who once said, "Music is a hard instrument."
Yeah, that's right.
And it's very true. They're very physical and very demanding. You mentioned practice. We all have to practice, especially when we're not working steadily. Now, if we're working, then, of course, you'll practice playing at night. But when you're not, if you're off a week or 2 weeks, which we have these weeks and weeks off, I for one have to, but I'm sure most people do.
I'd like to play one of the tunes that was recorded with you and Parker. And I should mention that also featured on here is Al Haig at the piano, I think Tommy Potter on bass, and let's see, who else? And Roy Haynes on drums.
Mm-hmm.
And this was made in 1949 at Carnegie Hall, and we're going to hear a recording of Coco. Can you remember this at all? Can you remember the night that this was made?
Yes, I do. We had a concert at Carnegie Hall. It wasn't supposed to be recorded. In fact, we were arguing with the recording setup backstage because we were never paid for it. But naturally, it was recorded and put out, like so many of the things we've done, and never been paid for. Now I'm glad.
Yeah,
now I'm glad for posterity and for historical reasons and the honor of being on an album with Carnegie Hall with Charlie Parker. But at that time, it was only $41.50, and I really believed that I was worth that. At least that.
Well, let's hear the session, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is trumpeter Red Rodney, and he's in Philadelphia for a performance tonight, a concert at the Stenton Diner, which is on Stenton and Washington Lane. And the concert's going to start at 8:30, and the MC for the concert is going to be WUHY's Bob Perkins. So now to the 1949 session. This is Coco taken at an incredible speed, Charlie Parker and Red Rodney. Sorry, a little technical error there. We're going to get to the real Coco now, made in 1949, with Red Rodney and Charlie Parker.
Thank you.
Okay, that was a recording of Coco made in 1949 at Carnegie Hall. My guest Red Rodney featured on trumpet, along with Charlie Parker on alto, Al Haig at the piano, Tommy Potter bass, and Roy Haynes drums. If you're just joining us, Red Rodney is my guest. He's joining us from New York, and he's in Philadelphia for a concert tonight at the Stenton Diner. The concert begins at 8:30, and it will be held at Stenton and Washington Lane in Philadelphia. At the time that you were playing with Parker, now in this band, for instance, the one we just heard, you and Al Haig are white and the rest of the players were black. Was there any tensions at that time between the white and black bop players?
None whatsoever. Traditionally and historically, the music business, and specifically the jazz business, had been free of all and any racial problems. We were literally brothers. We encountered many, many racial problems, especially on southern tours, but we encountered them up north also. We laughed at it, we accepted it, and we just went along with the program. But among ourselves, there's never been anything like that.
You've never experienced anything like that?
No, I understand it's happening now more than it did then. If it is, it's unfortunate, and I hope it settles itself and straightens out soon. I don't think it has any place in jazz.
There were a couple of disruptions in your career for stays in hospital or prison?
I have been a guest of the government
yes.
a couple of times in my life. It was due to drug addiction, and I got caught with my hands in the cookie jar. Quite a few times in Philadelphia, too. Looking back at it now, I think it was a bad law. I think the treatment that we got was wrong and unfair and uncivilized. Speaking for myself, it's probably the best thing that could have happened to me because I couldn't stop myself. And so going away for a long period of time, and especially the place they sent me, I didn't go to a prison. I went to a government hospital, which was in Lexington, Kentucky. It's no longer a hospital. Now it is a prison. But when I was there, it was a hospital. And the main treatment was abstinence. But of course, that's what you needed. I did 2 5-year sentences. First time I did 20 months out of the 5 years and made parole. The second time I did 28 months. And the second time was fine. That did it. I think I was ready for it. I think I was old enough. I was much more mature. I knew which direction I wanted to take my life.
Art Pepper was recently on the show, and he talked about when he got out of prison, and he was in prison for drug bust. He said that it was really hard to get back into music. Everybody basically wanted to see your arms, make sure that you were clean. They wanted to know where you'd been and check you out before letting you in anywhere. Did you experience anything like that?
Not so much, no. In the West Coast, it's a lot different than the East Coast. Now, the first time I came out, I went to the West Coast. It was rather difficult, but I was lucky. I went to Las Vegas and lived there for a long time and worked. They needed good, experienced, big band trumpet players. Now they have more than they need, but at that time they needed them. So I went right to work. If there were some suspicions, and there probably were, I never felt it. As long as I was able to take care of my job, which I always did anyway, even when I was addicted at my worst, I took care of my job.
Mm-hmm. When you had the stays in the hospital, were you able to practice while you were there, or was?
Oh yeah, sure. There was first time I went to Lexington. There were great musicians. There are many name musicians. I won't list them here, but you know all of them. And the band was great. In fact, people used to come from all over Kentucky and Ohio to see that band. Some of your biggest recording stars of today were in that particular band. The second time I went back, it was no longer any music department, so to speak, but the laws were much more liberalized at that time, and I used to get out 2-3 nights a week to teach at the University of Kentucky and give clinics and concerts. And the warden at that time was a real good guy, and he allowed this. The professors had called in and asked for me, and once he saw that I wasn't going to run away, I actually had a van and a credit card, government credit card, and the keys to the van, and could go myself into town 3-4 nights a week.
That's great.
Yeah, that was marvelous.
Did it give you any status within the institution to be a good musician?
Oh, of course. It always makes life a little easier. And then, of course, you have to be able to handle that status now. I've seen guys come in with similar opportunities, but they were younger. And they really believed that they were better than everybody else, and it soon ended for them. Fortunately, I was much older at the time, and I knew how to accept it and handle it, and I got along great.
Red Rodney, I'd like to play a session from the 1950s. It features you with a Philadelphia band, and I know some of our listeners may know Buddy Savage and Jimmy Golden, and it's hard to find recordings with them. So this is the three of you together from, when was this made? 1952. It's actually made in New York, not Philadelphia, but the folks are from Philadelphia.
We went up to New York for that date.
Can you recall something about your Philadelphia days in the 50s when you were playing in bands around here?
When I left Charlie Parker in 1952, that's when he came out with Bird with Strings, and it was very little work for me with that. I came back to Philly and got a band here, and we worked all over the place. We were rather successful for a local Philadelphia group. And it was during that period that we went to New York and did this. The only thing, it was a Columbia date at that time, and we didn't have material, say so. We had to record what they wanted us to record. But for the money and for the record date, we did it. So the tunes on there are not indicative of jazz, you know. And I wouldn't even say they were jazz. But we did it and took the money and ran. Drove right back to Philly.
Well, let's hear an example from this record. This is Red's Mambo, and we'll hear Red Rodney on trumpet, Buddy Savage on tenor, Jimmy Golden at the piano, recorded in 1952. Made in 1952, that was Red's Mambo, and Red Rodney is my guest. He's in Philadelphia to play at the Stenton Diner tonight at 8:30 on Stenton and Washington Lane. Well, you offered that as an example that of a record that you all went down to New York to record. You didn't get to play what you wanted to play. You got your money and you split right back to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
You had some other times playing when I know it was stuff that you didn't really want to be playing, but I guess you were doing it for economic reasons.
Oh, sure. I worked in Las Vegas for 12 years in the big showroom orchestras behind all the stars, which economically is very good. And living there was very nice, too. You know, you don't live right in the gambling section in the Strip. The way of life there is very nice. It's sort of like suburbia. And for musicians, they're very high-paid jobs. I did a lot of studio work on the West Coast, which is even more lucrative. Of course, there you have to play everything that they throw in front of you. And we all have to do those things.
But you didn't enjoy it.
Well, no, you don't enjoy it. It's like going to work.
It's like having a job.
It's really working. It's like having a job. True, they are highly paid. And good benefits and everything. See, we're cheated in jazz. We get nothing. We get no benefits. We don't even get Social Security taken out. If you don't pay it yourself at the end of the year, you don't get it. Now, a lot of the young people would rather have the money in cash without all of those deductions. But when you're young, you can think that way. When you get a little older, you realize, wait a minute, I don't have any hospital benefits. I don't have any Social Security benefits coming, whatever. We are cheated. This is the one art form in American life. And though it's getting a lot better and there's a big resurgence and we're getting more work and more respect, we're still not getting what we really deserve compared to other musicians. Who, of course, deserve what they're getting also, but we're not. And it's unfortunate, but I think I told you this before. Even with that, I think we're special. And I would rather just play for special audiences than have the mass audience. Because the mass audience listens to music with their feet. And we don't want to play to them. We want to play to people who really listen. And so if that's part of the price we have to pay, then I guess all of us are prepared to do so.
You've played in some other different countries. You've played in
Yeah, in fact,
Denmark?
Yeah, I lived in Denmark for 3 years.
Ah.
Yeah. And I played all over Europe many times. I just returned from Israel Sunday. I did a 2-week tour there. It was marvelous.
Did you get a big response?
Tremendous response. Tremendous. I was so pleasantly surprised because I didn't know they had any jazz traditions. In fact, they don't. But the musicians there were marvelous. The saxophone players were Russian immigrants who had just come, and they're very proficient, and they've heard all the records. In fact, they couldn't speak any English, and they're just in school now learning Hebrew. I was able to communicate with them because I remembered Yiddish a little bit, and they spoke very well. So we were able to talk about conditions and how they learned, and they asked me for all of the jazz players in America, how they were doing, what they did, how they did it, and they played great. The Israelis also played very well. They knew all the tunes, everything. I loved it. I had a ball.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. And there was one place in Jerusalem, the main jazz place, which is right, a block away from the wall city. It was a little cave. You went downstairs into a cave. And it was a jazz club.
Literally a cave.
It was a cave, yeah, made of stone. Well, all the buildings there are made of stone anyway. It's municipality law. But this wasn't as pretty as most of the other buildings. And it was just beautiful.
How did you get to tour Israel? How did you arrange that?
I was invited by the Israeli Jazz Society.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
That's really not the first place I'd think of as
Well, there's going to be a lot more.
There's
going to be a lot more now because the interest was great. I really wondered how much of an audience I was going to have, but the places were packed.
That's great. Let's listen right to a selection from a more recent album than the ones we've heard so far. And this is from your album Red, White, and Blues, and it was recorded in 1976 and issued in about 1978. We're going to hear something called No Jive Line. Do you want to say anything about the session before we hear it?
I flew in from Denmark to do this session. And we hadn't rehearsed. We didn't do anything. I met the guys right in the studio. Of course, I knew them, but we didn't have a chance to rehearse. I only had 2 days, and we did this date in 2 days. The tune No Jive Line is written by a Canadian pianist whom I worked with the week before. And I liked the tune, and I took it and recorded it. His name is Bernie Sinensky, and he's one of Canada's leading jazz piano players.
Okay, so we're going to hear Red Rodney on trumpet, Richie Cole on alto, Roland Hanna at the piano, Buster Williams bass, and Eddie Gladden drums. No Jive Line from the Red Rodney record, Red, White, and Blues on the Muse record label. Red Rodney is my guest, and he's in Philadelphia for a concert this evening at the Stenton Diner on Stenton and Washington Lane. You've been recording with Muse for quite a few years now, for about four or five
1970...
years?
1972 was my first album.
Yeah.
And yesterday, in fact, I just mixed my latest one, which, by the way, Turk Morrow is on that album, along with Richie Cole. On one side, the other side is Ricky Ford and Richie Cole, with Roland Hanna, George DeVivier, and Grady Tate. And it was marvelous mixing it, because I didn't like it when I walked out of the studio. I was having a bad dental problem, as you'll hear on the next album. Between this last album and this next album, I had hardly any teeth at all. And I needed implanted teeth. I couldn't have a plate, and I hadn't enough for a bridge. So I had a lot of trouble. Well, I was pleasantly surprised with this album when we mixed it. It came out great. And it's going to be released in another 2 months, I think.
Great, I'll look forward to that. Yeah, things like dental problems become very important if you play a wind instrument.
Well, I almost quit because I just could hardly play. And finally, last year I got implants put in, and they were quite successful, thank the Lord. And it's a whole new ball game for me now.
So you're recording with Muse now. Is it a formal contract?
Or yeah, it's a formal contract, but it's...
What's the relationship?
Well, I've signed a contract with Muse Records for 2 albums a year. And the money is good, and I get more each time. Complete freedom of anything you want to do. Producer, writing, whatever. He gives pretty good distribution, and he gets a lot of plays on the radio. Joe Fields, it's a one-man company, and he runs around all over the country doing what he can. And I think it's one of the better independent jazz companies. Of course, that's all he puts out. And so we're getting a fair share of the jazz market because that's all he does put out. And, I'm quite happy with Muse. In fact, I have another year to go, 3 more albums to make for them. And if he wants to sign me after that, I'll be glad to do that also.
As a musician, what do you think of things like liner notes? Do you like having liner notes on records? And is there a type of approach to writing them that you enjoy when it's your record?
Yes, that's a sore spot. Usually they give liner notes to someone who knows nothing about the music or about the people playing the music. The last two, I didn't even know the people who wrote the liner notes. One guy called me up in the middle of the night and said, well, I'm writing the notes, what do you do? This, that, and the other. When I complained to Joe Fields of Muse, he had good reason for it. He could get more plays, more distribution, more sales by the people he chose, and so I understood it. However, he promised to be more considerate next time, and I'll be able to recommend, at least, or suggest a person to write the notes. I would like it to be someone much more knowledgeable, not necessarily with me, but with the music.
What about album jacket covers?
Well, they are important. And I don't really have any talent for choosing anything like that, so I do leave it to him. But I know they are important. A lot of people like covers and buy albums. And unfortunately, a lot of disc jockeys like covers and play albums. Are they like the first cut on an album, and will play that, and never play any other cuts? Or if they don't like it, they won't even go through the whole record. They just won't play it if they didn't like the first cut. So we have this problem throughout this business.
When you started playing jazz, it was a time when if you went into a recording studio, you're going to be recording on a 78, and you had 3 minutes tops, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So if you took a solo, it was going to be a short one. Whereas now, if you have the freedom, the tracks can be as long as you please and the solos as long as you please. What to you is a comfortable length for a solo, or does that just depend on how you're feeling in the piece?
True, it depends on how you're feeling in the piece, but I like a happy medium. Now, in the big band days, when you had 3 minutes, of course you only could play one or two choruses. Today, I think too many people are playing too many choruses. Jolly Parker used to say, if I can't say what I have to say in three choruses, what's the use of saying any more? I agree with that. I may be a little old. The younger ones are playing a lot of choruses, and I believe that's the Coltrane influence. But, of course, he could play 20 choruses and say something on each one. He was unique. I think too many of them are playing too many choruses, and they never reach that high pitch. It becomes anticlimactic, and to some uninitiated listeners, in fact, many knowledgeable listeners, it becomes boring. I don't like the lengthy choruses either.
Well, you're going to be playing tonight at the Stenton Diner. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the people playing with you and what we can expect if you go tonight to the concert?
Well, Turk Morrow is here with us. He came down with me from New York. He's a marvelous player. He's been with Buddy Rich and a few other bands and is now on his own. He's just getting started, and he's a great player. Tenor, baritone. As I said, he's on my next album. He's got one of his own out, and I think he's about ready to do something else with Muse by himself. He don't know it yet, but I'm pretty sure he's going to be doing it. Mickey Roker, of course, is one of the greatest drummers in the world. He lives in Philly. He's here tonight. Ted Dunbar is a great guitarist who I've met in New York many times. Sam Dockery is a great piano player who lives in Camden, but he's always on the road, always in New York playing. I don't know the bass player. Jeff Hunter is his name?
Jerome
Hunter. I've never met him. I hear very good things about him, though. I'll be glad to hear him tonight.
Great. Well, and the MC for tonight's concert is going to be Bob Perkins, who does the Saturday Night Jazz Show here on WUHY. Mm-hmm. I hope you have a good concert this evening and a good stay in Philadelphia, your hometown. It's been a great pleasure to meet you, Red Rodney. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm glad you're able to come.